This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
This morning I'd like to discuss few short quotations from Robert Pippin's essay on the expressivist Nietzsche. The issue concerns what matters to us, which things matter because others do, and things that simply matter, that we could not imagine not mattering. Since we do not decide what ought to matter and thereby have it matter, and since things can matter to us we think ought not to matter, we have to call such commitments pre-reflective and pre-volitional, or I suggested, erotic attachments. We do not decide whom or what to love, who or what to care about. Nietzsche's diagnosis of nihilism was that it was not a crisis of credible belief or strength of will, but the failure of desire, the failure of mattering. Boredom would be an example. But the even more paradoxical thought is that Nietzsche seemed to think that one particularly catastrophic manifestation of nihilism is contentment, bovine satisfaction in the low and base, caring in the wrong things, not caring. In our practice, usually we begin with the fact that our suffering matters to us, and that we seek above all the end of that suffering, and that seems to be this kind of automatic or pre-reflective mattering, where we sort of have, of course, this is what motivates us, this is what we're doing. And yet, as we proceed, the whole question of what counts as an end to suffering becomes more and more problematic. And the issue then is whether what Nietzsche derives as bovine contentment is in fact what most of us are pursuing, what we call the end of suffering. See, Nietzsche is writing in the 19th century at a time when there's a crisis in Christianity. But it's a twofold kind of crisis. On the one hand, there's a kind of assault on the idea of God from the direction of science and Darwinism. But the one that I think concerns Nietzsche more, concerned Kierkegaard more, both of whom are addressing this crisis of faith, is rather that Christianity had become totally comfortable and adapted to bourgeois European life, that there was no seriousness to it, no challenge. To be a Christian meant nothing more than being a good law-abiding conformist. And each in their own way, Kierkegaard and Nietzsche said that this picture of Christianity was radically inadequate, and both criticized this kind of bovine contentment picture of religion. Kierkegaard wanted to challenge and radicalize Christianity, make it existentially matter again. Nietzsche felt like the slate was being wiped clean. We had to see what would come next. In our Zen practice, we certainly go through initial years where there's no question, as I say, that we're engaged in coming to terms or working through our own personal suffering. And the practice itself, the participation in a group practice and belonging to a sangha, can itself be very ameliorative to the things that we suffer from. I think if we have grown up in unhappy families, or with insecure attachments, or with loneliness, we cannot underestimate the psychological value of something that is steady, reliable, provides a kind of new group or family or identity. All these forms of secure attachment are psychologically very necessary, and yet seem to be at odds with much of the Buddhist language of detachment. And there's no question that for a great many people who enter into a lifelong commitment to practice, particularly in residential communities, the security and repetitiveness and reliability of the community and the practice and the form of belief are a big part of what they get out of it. And we would have to say that many times and places, monks have been accused of being the very paradigm of bovine contentment. So how do we escape settling into something comfortable and predictable in our practice? How do we make it more than that? In a certain sense, in Zen, we make the practice deliberately difficult so that physically it's an ongoing challenge. We don't let ourselves literally get too comfortable. And yet, when you've done this a long time, we master the difficulty, we settle into it. a very large part of Buddhism's attempt to deal with this problem of contentment is to remind ourselves of the suffering of others. That it's the Mahayana practice to forego our own individual contentment in the service of the salvation of others. The Bodhisattva vows not to enter into the contentment of nirvana until all others have entered into nirvana, which will be a long wait. Yet, in many ways, that commitment to the endless suffering of others is ambiguous in how we actually engage that, or how Buddhism historically has actively engaged that. It certainly didn't engage it by taking a vow of endless social work. There was no sense that Buddhism was engaged in attempting to relieve the material suffering of the poor, that it was not engaged in providing physical shelter or relief to those who lacked it. In fact, early Buddhist doctrine is that the very desire for safety and shelter and reliability are the roots of our suffering. So it's vow to relieve the suffering of all beings was not for a very long time engaged at that level at all. In fact, you could say it was the opposite. The life of the mendicant monk was a demonstration of how a paradoxical kind of contentment could be achieved in the very midst of uncertainty and impermanence. It's one of the radical transformations of contemporary Buddhism that it becomes socially concerned in very real world ways with the well-being of others. And it's not simply about providing a monastic model to the suffering of the world in which the wrong things are being desperately pursued. But there's no question that there's something like the Bodhisattva ideal that we have to embrace if we are not going to allow our practice to settle into the kind of bourgeois contentment that Kierkegaard and Nietzsche saw Christianity doing in the 19th century. And we have to try to formulate for ourselves what counts as a radical challenge to ourselves or to ourselves in a community. That will keep us flourishing rather than content. See, and I think for me, the distinction that Aristotle drew between flourishing, eudaimonia, and simple happiness is one way out of this bind. Because flourishing means that we actively exercise and develop our capacities to their fullest. Happiness is often a kind of settling into the lowest common denominators of pleasure. So what would be the difference as expressed in our practice? And certainly we can say that one version of the pursuit of simple contentment in meditation is the pursuit of simple states of consciousness, which are calm or pleasant, and use our meditation as a way to train ourselves to stay in those states as much as we can, as often as we can, and then avoid everything that's unpleasant. And one alternative is Joko's picture of meditation, which tries deliberately to stay at the edge of our anxiety or restlessness or anger as a way of not settling into that simple meditative buzz. For me, since this was about an essay called The Expressivist, Nietzsche, the expressivist form for me is trying to talk to you in a way that is not the delivering simple Buddhist platitudes week after week. You can imagine many teachers who have done that, often with great best-selling success. Clearly benefits a lot of people. Might even benefit you all more than a talk on Robert Pippin's essay on Nietzsche. However, I would have to shoot myself after a few months or years of that. So my version of it is to push myself to try to read and engage things like Pippin on Nietzsche and find a way to bring it to you in this talk. It's a stretch for me. I don't know what it does for you. We'll see. Each of us has to find that edge. Find what really pushes their practice or their engagement with Zen and with others forward. Each of you has to have your own answer.